Okay, so, third lecture already, week three. What we did last week, if you remember, we talked about those three paradigms of song, arrangement, and track. Now, without me going over this, you tell me what the differences are, broadly, between song, arrangement, and track. Let's start with song. What is that?
The concept in your head.
Yeah. So it's a sort of an abstract concept of a song. And what sort of ingredients would a song include? What would you expect to see in the sort of philosophical notion of a song?
Basic structure, chords, lyrics, effects on certain instruments.
Not so much the effects, but definitely lyrics would be part of it. Harmony, i.e. the chords. It would have a melody, and it would have some sort of basic arrangement. But what it wouldn't have necessarily is any associated sound. Do you see the difference? That's why it's abstract, because it hasn't got any sound attached to it. The sound becomes attached when you make a specific arrangement of it. And when you make a specific arrangement of a song, that's when you start getting things like distorted guitars, Fender Rhodes pianos, particular drum sounds, particular keyboard sounds, and so on and so forth. That comes in the arrangement. And then when you record the arrangement, when you make that permanent, it becomes the track. And I just want to once again just encourage you to think about those when you're listening to music. And certainly when you're thinking about analysing it, are you analysing? We'll do this today. Are you analysing the song, arrangement, or the track? Or are you actually analysing all three? That's just something for you to think about. And what I'm going to do every week is I'm going to suggest to you, now I can't trace this up, but I'm going to suggest to you that you do a little bit of reading every week between the sessions. I'll recommend it. And what I've done in most of the cases, not all of the cases, I've actually downloaded them, the files as PDF files, and I've put them on Blackboard. So you haven't even got to go to the library to look at them. But what I suggested last week, I didn't say we talk about this, so we're not going to discuss it, but what I suggested last week is to look at, because these are the key chapters for people who've spoken about song, arrangement, and track. So I suggest that you look at the Alban Zach, chapter 2 of Alban Zach, The Poetics of Rock. That's got a whole chapter which talks about the difference between song arrangement and track. And Alan Moore's book, you look at the book by Alan Moore entitled Song Means, it's a great big, thick, sort of 400-page sort of meisterwork, if you like, but page 15, one page of it, covers song arrangement and track. So it's worth supplementing what I say about it with what other people have said about it as well. That's why I've mentioned that. And what I also suggested last week is this, which is on Blackboard as well as a PDF, in the learning materials. What is a song by Philip McIntyre? Where basically, although he doesn't necessarily call it song arrangement and track, he gets into the philosophy of what exactly is a song. Does a song have sound? I mean, I'm telling you it doesn't. But I think, when you think about music and academic thought in general, it's quite often about differences of opinion. You're not going to agree with everything I say, and neither will other authors necessarily agree with everything I say. So what these sort of readings are between lectures, it's just to get you to get other people's opinions, some which might sort of substantiate what I've said, some that might go against what I've said, and I don't think that's a bad thing. But I didn't say last week that we would talk about it, so we won't do that this week, but I'll give you some reading at the end of this lesson, so we'll have a chat about it next week, because I think it's an important chapter for you to read. What we're going to talk about this week is this notion which is called the elements of music. Now, anyone who's come through, I was going to say A-level, even GCSE, when the national curriculum, you guys have obviously been brought up on the national curriculum, but when the national curriculum first came through around about 25, 30 years ago, the elements of music as a terminology came around for the first time. And the idea was, from primary school, i.e. age 4, all the way through to doing a PhD, music students should engage with the elements of music. Who's familiar with that term? I'm just curious. Just put your hand up if you've heard of it. I'm just really curious. There's quite a few of you haven't, which is interesting, because it should be part of the national curriculum. Really interesting that. Well, to give you a quick rundown, let me just backtrack a little bit. What I want to talk about today is, we're going to talk about the elements of music. If you remember, going back last week and the week before, I said there's three ways that we are going to think about analysing music. Who remembers what those three ways were? Three broad ways of thinking about music. I'll give you one. You can analyse the text itself. That's what the elements of music is. You can analyse the text itself. There was three circles, and the analysis of the text itself was in the middle. What are the other two? Pardon? Reception, good. Yeah, that was the one, if you like, that comes after the text itself. Okay, so you can analyse the reception of the text. And what's the other circle?
Production.
Think of that. Three ways you can analyse music. The text itself, the production of the text, so, you know, things like the social foundations of it, or how musicians make the music. And then the more complex one, which is the reception of the music. What we're going to talk about today is mainly the text itself. The elements of music are actually indoctrinated in the arrangement. You'll see that in a second. But what I'm also going to encourage you to do is to think a little bit about the reception as well. So mainly the text itself, but also some of the receptions. We won't really touch on the production. When you are analysing the text itself, the sort of things you could analyse, okay? You could analyse the melody, for example, and we will be doing that in a few weeks' time. How do you go about, what is it that makes a good melody? And how do you go about analysing that? I'll give you some tools where you can begin to think about that. Another way of analysing the text itself would be to analyse the harmony. Now, with that, you will need a certain amount of music theory knowledge if you want to go down that route. These are all things you can do. You can analyse the harmony. What you've got to remember, if you can just think of this, let's just take melody as a starting point, okay? I'm saying to you, the melody could be the analysis of the text itself. Does that make sense? So you're listening to the music, and the melody is in the text. It's in the music, so you can analyse it. But what you've got to remember with some of these things is they're part of more than one category. So, for example, with melody, you could analyse the production of a melody. You could analyse how a composer, a songwriter, or even yourself, how do you come up with a good melody? That's the analysis of the production of it. And it could even dip into the reception, where you think, what does the melody mean to me? What does it pass on to me? So what I'm saying to you, although what I'm talking about today is mainly text, it's the music, there is a bit of overlap. Does that make sense? Does it make sense? There's overlap between when you analyse the text, it can sort of turn over to the production and also the reception of the music as well. Okay, so what are the elements of music? There's a limitless number of elements, to be honest, but what I've done today is just focus on some key ones that I think are important. Let's just see if you know what they are. So, for example, if I said timbre, what would that mean? What is timbre? Yeah?
The sound of the instruments.
Yes.
So like
Yeah, it's the sound of an individual instrument, isn't it? So, for example, you could have a distorted guitar. That would be the timbre of the guitar. Or it could be, sometimes with a timbre, it's actually got a timestamp. If anyone's heard Phil Collins' drum sound from about 25, 30 years ago on the solo records, they've got a stamp of the 1980s. The timbre sort of reminds us of a particular time. But for the moment, if you just think of it as being the sound of an instrument, and what you can do, you can write about that. You think, I think what we tend to do when we listen to music, we listen to it and go, well, that's the sound. But you start to unpick that. I mean, you know, to use the example that I've just said there, that it's a distorted guitar. That's doing the distorted guitar an injustice, really, isn't it? What is it that makes it distorted? Look at interviews of the guitar player, find out what gear they use, what amplifier does it go through, how is it being produced in the studio? What is it? What type of distortion is it? You know, is it a real sort of death metal type uncompressed distortion where it tends to be really big, or is it a really compressed, narrow type of distortion? So suddenly, with each of these elements, what you should find, it opens up discussion. Each one of them does that. So timbre being one. Texture. How is texture different from timbre? Go on, hazard a guess, if you don't know. I am surprised some of you don't know this. I thought you would have done this available.
Texture of the piece.
So what is the texture of the piece? Yeah, if that's... You're on the right lines.
Is texture the speed and how, like, what sort of scales they're using? So
no, it's simpler than that.
Just how many instruments are in there, how big it sounds, if it's a smaller texture, or you know, if it's a small arrangement of musicians or a big orchestra.
That's right.
Texture.
Yeah, that. It's, call it the thickness. The thickness of the. So, like you say, you can have a very thin texture where it could be a single vocal part. A cappella vocals, one voice, be really thin, not usually, be quite a thin texture. Or you can have a full orchestra, which has got so many different instruments. It's almost like you take a slice, if you imagine you've got a cake, which is the mix, it's like you slice it down the middle, and you can look into it and go, that's the texture. It's lots of different instruments. And quite often you can talk about, in the texture as well, things like stereo placement, effects that are being used. It really sort of opens that up. We'll come more onto that later. So texture is the collection of instruments. And why is that important? Because you'll find in a lot of music, it's how interest, we don't even think about it. We listen to a piece of music. These elements of music are used to create interest. And if you've got an element that doesn't create a lot of interest, for example, it might just be, it's in 4-4. It's in 4-4 from beginning to end. You'll find that unless there's interest in some of the elements, the song's going to be boring. And you can use this to analyse your own music. The interest has to come from somewhere. And texture is one of the places where it can come from, where you can start off with a very thin texture, develop into a thick texture, perhaps go thin again. You know, variety of texture and variety of timbre. You know, even, you know, you listen to really great guitar players, they tend to vary their timbre, their tone, and it creates variety. Harmony, I think, speaks for itself. It's the chords. And chords can create interest. Sometimes pieces of music are made up of one or two chords. You know, there's no harmonic. You wouldn't do a Roman numeral analysis of a James Brown track, for example. Because what you would get, you know, normally E7 with a sharp and ninth. That's it. One chord. So what happens is, the interest comes from other places. It doesn't come from the harmony. So this would have a sort of a bit of a low interest. Does it begin to make sense? You sort of think of them individually, and the interest comes from somewhere. Dynamics. What's dynamics? How can you talk about that?
It goes, starts off quite quiet and come in loud. Dynamics is more of a word for all of these things all together as kind of a
Yeah, it could be. I mean, sometimes it can be individual instruments, but quite often you'll find that there's differences of dynamics in a mix. It might start off quiet, it'll go loud, go quiet, or sometimes you might find that individual instruments do that. So considering the dynamics in that is another way of getting interest. So basically the volume and how the volume changes in the mix. The melody we've already spoken about, that there are ways of analysing how a melody gains interest, and we'll look at that in a couple of weeks' time. You can sort of hear that. You don't need music theory to understand it. You can actually hear the building blocks of what songwriters use to develop melodies. And quite often there's a difference between the sort of classic pop formula, if you like, which has huge amounts of repetition in it, and more experimental, say dance music, quite often it not have as much repetition in it. Or it might have more repetition, depending on the type of dance music that you're listening to. So melody can be another thing that you can pick. You know, when do the really high notes come in? What would happen in a melody if you didn't have any repetition? People wouldn't be able to latch onto it. You know, popular song uses repetition to the nth degree. And I think most of us, anyone, most people I've come across, barring a couple of exceptions, have just got an intuitive understanding of that. You haven't got to analyse it. You write music and you just automatically repeat. You just do it. And it's quite often interesting to look back at your own practice and think, how am I doing that? Why am I doing that? Why am I repeating stuff like this? You can analyse your own practice as well. And if you think, okay, the melody isn't sounding particularly great, you can begin to use, or there's something missing in the melody. You can use these sort of techniques to identify issues and try and collect them and try and correct them. Rhythm speaks for itself, but we could, I think, in popular song context, we could think of groove as well. So particular rhythms, okay, you know, that would be, say, a particular drum rhythm, or it might be a particular rhythm that the bass player or the guitar player is playing. But you think of it also in terms of groove. What's the difference between rhythm and groove?
The groove might be a certain riff that's repeated over through the song, whereas the rhythm might be a certain drum beat, and then the groove kind of goes on top of it to make it a rhythm.
Yeah, it's the last bit that I'm interested in. It's because they're very similar, but it's the interlocking of rhythm that's a groove, isn't it? So you've got a particular drum rhythm, which then quite often will have a particular bass rhythm, which will then have a particular guitar rhythm, a particular vocal rhythm, and you're layering these rhythms on top of one another, and you end up with a particular groove. And that particular groove, we quite often associate with being called a style. It's a country and western style, which, for example, wouldn't have a great deal of syncopation in there. Or it's a funk style, which will have loads of syncopation in there. Syncopation being the rhythms are quite often off the beat, not on the beat when your foot's on the floor. So, yeah, what are the rhythms? And how are they creating interest in the music? Do they change, or do they stay the same all the way through? Mix, I think, also speaks for itself. We'll come on to this in a couple of weeks' time, but what I'm interested in with mix just today is getting people to think, how are the instruments proportioned in the stereo spectrum? And I'm talking about three-dimensional space. I'm talking about not just left and right. So, you know, the bass could be there, the guitar could be here, the drums could be at the back. I don't know how easy it is to hear it on these, but you certainly will get to hear it when you put headphones on. Talking about that. But also talking about front to back. You know, there's techniques that are used in the track, in the mixing of the track, that put instruments at the front of a mix or put them at the back of a mix. What would do that? What is the most obvious effect to do that?
Padding.
Well, padding would put it left to right. But what puts it front to back?
Volume.
Volume could do that, yeah. So you could have a loud instrument which would give the illusion of it being at the front, or a quiet instrument which would give it the illusion of being near the back. But there's another, it's at the level, because the volume, I think, would be at the level of normally the arrangement. I'm talking about at the level of the track.
Where the microphones are placed to record it?
Yeah, it could be that. I'm thinking of a studio effect. So it could be mic placement. In fact, that's exactly what used to happen in the original recordings in the 19... for example, when the original Dixieland jazz band recorded those really early jazz tracks at about 1915, 1916, that's what they did. And one mic.
And they
just had to position themselves at a distance from the mic in order to... It wasn't in terms of stereo space, it was mono, but in order to get the right volume. What I'm thinking about... What's that? Reverb and compression. Good. Those two effects, usually in combination. Reverb, what that does, it tends to give you the illusion that you're in a bigger space. And what you can do, you can put more reverb on a particular instrument, which makes it sound like it's further back in the mix. And compression tends to sort of bring things forward. So you can... And it's learning to recognise those things. I think, you know, as musicians, they're the sort of things we need to learn to recognise. What is it that makes it do that? And trying to investigate that. That's what I mean by mix. We'll do more of that. Now, what I want you to do, after I've gone through this, I'm going to give you a little task as a group to listen to some music and start thinking about those things.
So, when I'm going back to the mix, so the reverb and compression, would you be
good question. I mean, would you need... Yeah. In my own case, I'm not from a science background. I tend to have more interest in, getting sound as opposed to understanding how the sound happens. And there is a level of musicology which gets into that, but I hold my hands up and say it's not that. I haven't got the expertise for that. It's to do with the front end. You know, yes, I use compression, but I don't know how it works behind the... and I'm not negating that, it's just it's beyond my expertise.
Okay.
So how do we consider those elements of music? Okay, I've listed about 10 of them there. How do we use that in music analysis? How can we use that? So I think first if you're thinking, if I say to you in the exam, right, analyse this piece of music. In the exam, I play the music, and you've got 2 hours to write an analysis. And you're thinking, well, how do I get started with this? A really good way to get started is to simply just list the elements of music. Just listen. And what you can do, you can just start off by just making notes about how each of those elements work in the song. And I mentioned 2 big words here. We can talk about them diatonically. All that means is through time. How do the elements of music change as the song progresses through time? So certain instruments might get louder or quieter. There might be a difference in timbre. There might be a difference in mix. You might get some instruments which move from the left to the right. It's not a static mix, it's a mobile mix. How do the elements change through time? And the other way to think about it is synchronically. And what synchronically is more to do with, it's using that cake analogy that I said before, where if you can imagine you could take a mix. Okay, it's almost like, imagine your favourite record. You could go into a studio and actually see the Pro Tools software in operation. And you can stop it at any point, and you could look and go, that's what's happening. I can see these instruments are playing, but this one's quieter than this one, there's a bit of reverb added, there's some delay added here, there's some compression, but it's at a particular point in time, like you're sort of looking straight through the mix. And although it's difficult, that, I mean, there has been, some of you I'm sure have seen this over the last few years, there's a lot of stem cell stuff around these days. Have you seen any of that? The stem cells of particular mixes which you can get? I find them really interesting. I got a whole load of the police stem cells when I was writing the book on Sting, and although I didn't include it in the analysis, it was just really interesting to see what was going on, the effects that were on the guitar, the way that the instruments sort of interacted, and you can stop it at any point and go, ah, okay, that's what's going on there. That's what I mean by synchronic, as opposed to diachronic, which is through time. Has anyone put a form chart together? You know what I mean by a form chart? I did consider putting a diagram of one up. If you can imagine what a form chart is imagine you've got an Excel spreadsheet, and down here you've got the instruments. Okay, so you've got like vocals, two guitars, bass, keyboards, and drums, say. Okay, you've got that down here. And then along the top, what you've got is the form of the music. So it might be introduction, verse, chorus, middle eight, key change, so on and so forth. And then what you do on the Excel spreadsheet, you just fill in when the instruments are playing. And quite often what you can do, you can put a bit of a descriptor in there as well. Does that make sense? So what you do, you can actually see, by looking at a form chart, when the instruments are playing, and you can see a description. You might sort of have things on there where you can see certain instruments getting louder or quieter. A form chart is quite often a good way of getting started with music analysis. What I can do, if you're unsure about that, we could perhaps do a little session on that, just spend 15, 20 minutes sort of explaining through what a form chart is that you could use. What these are just ways of getting into musical analysis. What you could also do with this, and this is the way it's normally taught in schools, believe it or not, but they don't talk about it, obviously, at the same level we're going to talk about it. Once you've identified the elements of music, you've identified particular textures and timbres and so on and so forth, start to think, what do they mean? Do they mean anything? Start off with yourself. You know, you might find, like I mentioned before, you know, Phil Collins drum sound. Now, I use that deliberately because that was out in the sort of mid-80s when I was around about your age. When I was into a Phil Collins drum sound, for those of you who don't know, he developed this sound in Genesis, the band Genesis. It's a really huge drum sound with a lot of reverb. And it was quite iconic at the time. Now, to me, that will probably take me back to a time. With you, you probably think it sounds old-fashioned. I can understand that. I'm like that when I listen to music of the 60s. It sounds old-fashioned automatically. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's the same sound, but it's got a different perception. So you can do that with these elements. You can link them to what they mean to you. And last but not least, and this is what I want you to do when you listen to the music now. Which ones are the most important? That's the hard thing. You listen to the elements of music and you think, right, okay, which are the elements that are the most important in this particular mix? How do you prioritize them? So what I want you to do, let's just fast forward a little bit here. And you can go through this bit here. What I'm going to do, put you into small groups of like two or three, and I'm going to play you a piece of music, and I want you to think about these four questions. Could you write them down? Reason being, for some reason in this room, when I play music, I've got to switch the screen off, I've got to go across to the laptop, so you won't be able to see these at the same time as I'm playing music. So what I want you to think about, first of all, how analytically important are each of the elements. I'll give you the list of the elements in a second, but which ones are the most important in the mix? And give reasons for that. You know, it might be like, for example, a 4-4 drum rhythm which goes all the way through. Is that going to be important? You've got to decide yourself. Or is if it's a really complex chord progression that changes key loads, is that going to have analytical importance? How important is it in the song? So first of all, I want you to do that. I'm interested in when we identify the elements of music, does any of them portray any particular meaning? It may not, to be honest. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. With this, it's hard, fast, you can do this, no problem. This is doable. This, it depends what side of bed you get out of in the morning in terms of if it means anything. It may or it may not. So don't get too hung up with that. Most importantly, how could you begin to use the elements of music as a starting point for analysis? So hypothetically, if I said to you, here's a piece of music, I want you to analyse it. How can you begin to use this for analysis? And last question that I want you to think about in groups is, with the elements that you're listening to, are they housed in song, arrangement, or track? Which is the dominant force? So what you're listening to, is the song the dominant force? Is the arrangement the dominant force? Is the track the dominant force? Or is it some sort of mixture of the
all? You don't really say number three.
Yeah.
With an analysis. Is that like, for example, say if a song was in a particular year, which was quite revolutionary, that analysis for that time that it was released?
Yeah, that could be, depending on what the song is.
Specifically just the music?
No, it could be the context. Could be the context, but I'm interested in how you can use what you've done here. You've put the analytical priority of the different elements. How can you use that for analysis? This is an easy one. These get a little bit more difficult. But so what we're going to do, let's just listen to a piece of music. Depending on time, I might even play it a couple of times. Let's see how much time we've got. I might play twice. And the elements that I want you to think about are these ones. You might want to just make a very quick note of them. So, melody, harmony, lyrics, the form of the music, the texture, the tempo, the meter, the timbre, the dynamics, and the mix. And if there's anything else that comes to mind that you hear, add that in as well if you want. I know one thing I've missed off straight away because of the one I've chosen. Groove. I think groove should be in there. You might want to add that in. I think you'll probably feel like you'll find it important. Just give you a second to write them down. And then we'll listen to the music. Okay, so let's just split you up into groups. So we'll just do it on table, I think. If we say this table here, okay, this table, perhaps the three of you, okay, you two at the back, three of you, two of you, three, and two. Just do it like that. What time is it now? 22, okay. So we've probably got time to listen to it a couple of times. Okay. I'll put the elements back on so you can see it. Who's heard of it, by the way? Who's heard it? I never take this for granted because who's heard it?
Let me see, I'm curious.
So everyone's heard it, which is good. I was hoping that, but I never take these things for granted.
I think it was used in like a really famous kind of like kids' film of most of our generation, I think.
Yeah, it was in a film. I forget which film it was. Yeah, yeah. I remember the original, but yeah, it was used in a
Shark Tale.
What was it?
Shark Tale.
Shark Tale. That's it. Yeah, that's right. So. Just go through each of these elements. What I would do is go through each of the elements and just try and consider these questions. Go through them one by one. Debate which ones are important. What I should have said, guys, is let's do a, if you can think right, notionally, of a number. Let's say 10 is important, and let's say 1 is not important. To give these a notional number as well, that will help you sort of prioritise it. As you put them in order, just sort of list them and give them a notional number. See if you can reach some sort of agreement. It's not, this isn't exact, but just to get you thinking about which ones are important and which ones aren't important, and most importantly, why? Why? That's what you've got to try and think. Why are they unimportant or important? You might find that you disagree. You probably will disagree.
Yeah.
Okay, I know I haven't given you a lot of time to think about it. You need a lot more time, but let's just talk about each of the elements, and let's just, if you've given some of them numbers, don't worry if you have, if they're half great, at least we can talk about if we think they're important, if we think they're not important, why, and if there is any meaning associated either with the song as a whole, or maybe particular elements that are channeling the meaning. You see what I mean? It might be the song in its entirety. You mentioned before, Shark's Tale. So it reminds many of you probably of Shark's Tale as an entity. But for example, does the groove of the that particular element of the song allude to something else? Does it channel your meaning into something else? So it might be there's loads of stuff being written today which has got the sort of groove to it, if you like.
70s America kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's that's what it's associated with, isn't it? Very much based in mid-70s America. But it might have connotations with today, for some of you, I don't know. Let's start off. I'll tell you what, I'm not necessarily going to do it in order that's here. Let's start off with harmony, because I know that's an interesting one. Generally speaking, who would consider the harmony to be a really important ingredient? Who would put it near the top? Who put it near the top, or who would think it's near the bottom?
Near the top, yeah.
So near the top. It's an important ingredient. Why?
Because there's that bass lines, and then claps come in, and the guitar, they all come in together, and then when the strings come in as well, it all like ties it all. We thought it tied it all nicely together.
But that sounds like more texture. I'm talking about harmony. So by harmony, I just mean how often do the chords change? Do the chords change a lot?
There's a lot of harmony in the chorus and things as well, which is important.
But it's that. It, yeah. Okay. So does it change in the chorus for the verse? By harmony, I'm sort of about chords.
Oh, right, okay.
Chords. The frequency of the chords and the degree to which the chords change. There's a lot of similarity, isn't there? A lot of similarity in that song. That's it. Because that's this, isn't it? The way the instruments fit together, what all I'm talking about with harmony is literally just, if you were going to analyse this piece of music, right, and imagine you've got 10 subheadings, which one could you write the most about? Could you write a lot about the chords?
No.
Could you write a lot about the chords? I would argue, if you were just talking about the types of chords that were used and how they change, this piece is based largely on one chord. It's only going to get to the middle section where it changes. So, you see, harmonically, it doesn't change much. There is an alternative argument with that, though. I'm curious if anyone's come up with it. So you could say, okay, the harmony doesn't provide a lot of interest, so there's not a lot to say about it. There's not a lot to say about the harmony. If I was writing out the chords, it would be, I think it was an E9th or something, which goes through nearly all the piece, and you come up with some change in the middle eight, and it goes back to the E9th again. And, that's similar to like a lot of 60s James Brown music. A lot of the funk music that came through in the late 60s was based on single chords. That's where that comes from. But what's the alternative argument to that? Is there one? Did you come up with one?
Repetition is good, maybe.
Repetition isn't just good. You could argue that in this style of music, it's essential. In this style of music, because the chords are in a particular context, what would happen if someone commissioned you to write a bit of mid-70s disco, and you just had loads of chords in it, would it be authentic? I don't know, I would think possibly not. Well, what does the one chord do? It frees up, potentially, the interest to happen in other places. Your attention is more driven towards other elements. Yeah? Yeah, so it leaves quite a lot of space. That's an interesting one. Space for your participation in it. Which, no one said that. It's quite an interesting one, that. But you can see there could be two arguments. On one level, there's not a lot to say, because there's not many chords. On a second level, it supplies a degree of authenticity, because that sort of music tended not to have a lot of chords. The interest came from elsewhere. What did you notice about the form of the music when you were listening? The bit that we listened to, it did go on a bit more than that, but I didn't choose the singles version. I chose the album version, it's too long. But what would you say about that?
It was like a gradual build-up, instrument by instrument, one by one.
Definitely, and that fits into texture. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Part of the thing we're trying to do here, clarify what we said. So texture is exactly that. It's how the instrument sort of built up. And we could argue, if we stayed on texture, there's a lot of interest in that, isn't it? In texture. There mightn't be a lot of interest in the harmony, but in the texture, it starts off with very thin texture, gradually gets bigger, and then if you listen to it all the way through, if you drew a sort of a bar chart, if you like, it would be thick texture, thin texture, thick, it tends to fluctuate. A lot of the interest comes from the texture, and often through the gradual introduction of instruments. And what you can do when you start to analyse this sort of thing, you can then think, what else does that? What other music of the time was doing that? And you can draw that into the argument as well. What music that you listen to does the same thing? And suddenly you're beginning to develop a bit of an analysis here when you're starting to do that. But going back to form, did anyone notice any particular traits or anything unusual about the form at all? It was as standard as it gets, I would say, the form. Introduction, remember it had that introduction, and then up to the point we listened to, it was verse, chorus, and then it had a sort of a middle eight section. And you'll also notice, we get used to this. I didn't count the bars, but the bars were symmetrical in as much that I think there were 8-bar sections. We get so familiar with 8-bar sections. We know, even if you haven't heard a bit of music before, you're listening to it through, you know when the chorus is going to come. You ever done that? You just know when it's going to happen, because you know it's like 8-bar verse, right, it's going to be the chorus next, right, the chorus is going to end here. And what the song does, it sort of fulfills your expectations. You think, yeah, I know that's going to happen next before it's even happened. We'll come on to that more later. Yeah?
I'm going to have to replace my code. I just going to answer it, but yeah.
Yeah? All right. So, yeah, what we could have done is count the number of bars in the intro, the verse, the chorus. I think we'd probably find there were 8-bar sections. There wasn't anything unusual. You find a lot of music, for example, at the same time, in fact, before then, Motown music quite often played around with that, what we call the rule of eight, and you'd find there'd be like 11-bar verses and 7-bar choruses. So they played around with the form a little bit. I didn't hear that in that song, listening to it through. Any other elements like that were particularly interesting, or for that matter, not interesting?
The mix.
Yeah,
come
on.
You probably talk about the tone, bro.
Yeah, that's right. The timbre of the instruments, for example, Nile Rodgers' guitar sound, that Fender Stratocaster with an out-of-phase pickup, such a classic guitar sound, which is used a lot these days. You know, you hear it loads. He's had a bit of a renaissance, hasn't he? Nile Rodgers, the bass sound, the drum sound, so particular textures, particular timbres, the sound of the individual instruments were of a particular time in a way. That sort of slap bass sound, which was really becoming common in the mid-70s. As I say, the funk-type guitar, really basic drum sound. What's the tempo? We've all come familiar with this, 120 beats a minute. The dance tempo, it was fitting into that very much, sort of two beats a second. It's the rhythm that most dance music's written in. So it fulfilled a lot of traits.
The other thing that's important is I've heard the lyrics.
Yeah.
And this way, it's just says that they
look
like
the ages. Yeah, that makes sense. Yes, that's true. Yeah, that's true. And as you say, what goes on in the other elements, the simplicity of the form, basic drums, the build-up of the texture, arguably highlights the lyrics.
It's like a driving bass, and it kind of goes all the way through the song, and the lyrics kind of on about repeating and just keep on going, working, so the bass and the lyrics are kind of...
Sort of matches in with the...
In terms of meaning, that could be linked up like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's a good thing to look for, that, actually, how the musical bits of a piece of music link in to the lyrics. How do they link in? You find sometimes it's really obvious, but this is stuff we'll look at more as the weeks go by. But hopefully that's given you a bit of a starting point to the way that you can actually think about analysing music. Just to finish off, what I want to draw to your attention is if you go through your student portal, I just want to highlight the fact that there's an interface called NetLibrary. And in NetLibrary, there's quite a lot of popular music-based books in there that you can actually gain online access to. That's just a few of them. This is a great book, Alan Moore's book, Analyzing Popular Music. Just, you know, you can actually access that without going to the library through NetLibrary. This one as well by Roy Shuker, really good book to read, and anyone's interested in the Beatles, this isn't all of the books, this one's good as well, What to Listen For in Rock by Ken Stevenson. So you can access those books literally by just going on to NetLibrary. Has anyone looked at NetLibrary yet?
I don't know, actually.
Yeah, that's why I put it up, because quite often it's just overlooked.
Free as well,
it's free, yeah, you can get it through the student portal.
That's true.
And just to finish, what I would like you to do as well for next week, and what we'll do, we'll start next week's session by talking about this. So I do want you to read this. On Blackboard, I've put up a paper. It's a book chapter, actually, from a full book, but it's written by a guy called Stan Hawkins, and It's the analysis of a Prince song, Anastasia. And the reason I wanted to read it is it's quite a nice sort of introductory way of an example of how you can analyse a piece of music using some of the techniques that we've spoken about the last 2 weeks. I think the best way to learn about how to write about music is to read how other people do it. There needs to be an element of that. And rather than trying to sort of cram it all in right at the end before an assessment or something like that, just try and get into the habit of just gradually reading as the weeks go by. I'm not always giving you a book chapter, sometimes it might just be a page. But I'd like you to read a chapter. It'll probably take you about 45 minutes to read. What I'll do, I'll put it in a really obvious place in the learning materials. It's already up there, but it might be a bit further down. I'll put it near the top so you can see it when I upload this lecture. And we'll discuss that next week. All right, guys, thank you very much. Before you go, can I ask you to do one thing? So I'm seeing, obviously, the CSM students next to this, the seminar, but I need to start getting a bit of an idea of who's in it, because, I'm meeting all of you for the first time. So can I ask you just to look for your name on this, put a tick. If for any reason your name isn't on this list, could you just write it at the bottom? I just need to get a bit of a grip of who I'm seeing. I'll pass that around. Thanks very much.